Side 8, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, continuing on page 264. Thousands were disappointed to have to hear me instead, or other poor substitutes for Mr. Muhammad in person. Members of the nation were deeply concerned. Doctors recommended a dry climate. The nation bought Mr. Muhammad a home in Phoenix, Arizona. One of the first times I visited Mr. Muhammad there, I stepped off a plane into flashing and whirring cameras until I wondered who was behind me. Then I saw the cameraman's guns. They were from the Arizona Intelligence Division. The wire of our Nation of Islam brought all Muslims the joyful news that the Arizona climate did vastly relieve the messenger's suffering. Since then, he has spent most of each year in Phoenix. Despite the fact that Mr. Muhammad, convalescing, could no longer work the daily long hours he had previously worked in Chicago, he was now more than ever burdened with heavy decision-making and administrative duties. In every respect, the nation was expanded both internally and externally. Mr. Muhammad simply could no longer allot as much time as previously to considering and deciding which public speaking, radio, and television requests he felt I should accept, as well as to some organizational matters which I had always brought to him for advice or decision. Mr. Muhammad evidenced the depth of his trust in me. In those areas I have described, he told me to make the decisions myself. He said that my guideline should be whatever I felt was wise, whatever was in the general good interests of our Nation of Islam. "Brother Malcolm, I want you to become well known," Mr. Muhammad told me one day, "because if you are well known, it will make me better known," he went on. "But Brother Malcolm, there is something you need to know. You will grow to be hated when you become well known, because usually people get jealous of public figures." Nothing that Mr. Muhammad ever said to me was more prophetic. Chapter 15, Icarus. The more places I represented Mr. Muhammad on television and radio and at colleges and elsewhere, the more letters came from people who had heard me. I'd say that 95% of the letters were from white people. Only a few of the letters fell into the Dear Nigger X category or the death threats. Most of my mail exposed to me the white man's two major dreads. The first one was his own private belief that God wrathfully is going to destroy this civilization. And the white man's second most pervading dread was his image of the black man entering the body of the white woman. An amazing percentage of the white letter writers agreed entirely with Mr. Muhammad's analysis of the problem, but not with his solution. One odd ambivalence was how some letters, otherwise all but championing Mr. Muhammad, would recoil at the expression, "white devils." I tried to explain this in subsequent speeches. Unless we call one white man, by name, a devil, we are not speaking of any individual white man. We are speaking of the collective white man's historical record. We are speaking of the collective white man's cruelties and evils and greeds that have seen him act like a devil toward the non-white man. Any intelligent, honest, objective person cannot fail to realize that this white man's slave trade and his subsequent devilish actions are directly responsible for not only the presence of this black man in America, but also for the condition in which we find this black man here. You cannot find one black man, I do not care who he is, who has not been personally damaged in some way by the devilish acts of the collective white man. Nearly every day, some attack on the black Muslims would appear in some newspapers. Increasingly, a focal target was something that I had said, Malcolm X as a demagogue. I would grow furious reading any harsh attack upon Mr. Muhammad. I didn't care what they said about me. Those social workers and sociologists, they tried to take me apart, especially the black ones, for some reason. Of course I knew the reason. The white man signed their paychecks. If I wasn't polarizing the community, according to this bunch, I had erroneously appraised the racial picture, or in some statement I had overgeneralized, or when I'd made some absolutely true point, Malcolm X conveniently manipulated. Once one of my Mosque 7 Muslim brothers who worked with teenagers in a well-known Harlem community center showed me a confidential report. Some black senior social worker had been given a month off to investigate the black Muslims in the Harlem area. Every paragraph sent me back to the dictionary. I guess that's why I've never forgotten one line about me. Listen to this. The dynamic interstices of the Harlem subculture have been oversimplified and distorted by Malcolm X to meet his own needs. Which of us, I wonder, knew more about that Harlem ghetto subculture? I, who had hustled for years in those streets, or that black snob status symbol educated social worker. But that's not important. What's important to my way of thinking about it is that among America's 22 million black people, so relatively few have been lucky enough to attend a college. And here was one of those who had been lucky. Here was, to my way of thinking, one of those educated Negroes who never had understood the true intent or purpose or application of education. Here was one of those stagnant educations, never used except for parading a lot of big words. Do you realize this is one of the major reasons why America's white man has so easily contained and oppressed America's black man? Because until just lately, among the few educated Negroes, scarcely any applied their education, as I am forced to say the white man does, in searching and creative thinking, to further themselves and their own kind in this competitive, materialistic, dog-eat-dog white man's world. For generations, the so-called educated Negroes have led their black brothers by echoing the white man's thinking, which naturally has been to the exploit of white man's advantage. The white man, give him his due, has an extraordinary intelligence, an extraordinary cleverness. His world is full of proof of it. You can't name a thing the white man can't make. You can hardly name a scientific problem he can't solve. Here he is now solving the problems of sending men exploring into outer space and returning them safely to Earth. But in the arena of dealing with human beings, the white man's working intelligence is hobbled. His intelligence will fail him altogether if the humans happen to be non-white. The white man's emotions superseded his intelligence. He will commit against non-whites the most incredible spontaneous emotional acts. So psyche deep is his white superiority complex. Where was the A-bomb dropped? To save American lives. Can the white man be so naive as to think the clear import of this ever will be lost upon the non-white two-thirds of the Earth's population? Before that bomb was dropped, right over here in the United States, what about the 100,000 loyal, naturalized, and native-born Japanese-American citizens who were herded into camps behind barbed wire? But how many German-born naturalized Americans were herded behind barbed wire? They were white. Historically, the non-white complexion has evoked and exposed the devil in the very nature of the white man. What else but a controlling, emotional devil so blinded American white intelligence that it couldn't foresee that millions of black slaves, freed, then permitted even limited education, would one day rise up as a terrifying monster within white America's midst? The white man's brains that today explore space should have told the slave master that any slave, if he is educated, will no longer fear his master. History shows that an educated slave always begins to ask and next demand equality with his master. Today, in many ways, the black man sees the collective white man in America better than that white man can see himself. And the 22 million blacks realize increasingly that physically, politically, economically, and even to some degree socially, the aroused black man can create a turmoil in white America's vitals, not to mention America's international image. I'd not intended to stray off. I'd been telling how in 1963 I was trying to cope with the white newspaper, radio, and television reporters who were determined to defeat Mr. Muhammad's teachings. I developed a mental image of reporters as human ferrets, steadily sniffing, darting, probing for some way to trick me, somehow to corner me in our interview exchanges. Let some civil rights leader make some statement displeasing to the white public power structure, and the reporters, in an effort to whip him back into line, would try to use me. I'll give an example. I'd get a question like this. Mr. Malcolm X, you've often gone on record as disapproving of the sit-ins and similar Negro protest actions. What is your opinion of the Montgomery boycott that Dr. King is leading? Now, my feeling was that although the civil rights leaders kept attacking us Muslims, still they were black people. Still they were our own kind. And I would be most foolish to let the white man maneuver me against the civil rights movement. When I was asked about the Montgomery boycott, I'd carefully review what led up to it. Mrs. Rosa Parks was riding home on a bus, and at some bus stop, the white cracker bus driver ordered Mrs. Parks to get up and give her a seat to some white passenger who had just got on the bus. I'd say, now just imagine that. This good, hard-working, Christian-believing black woman, she's paid her money, she's in her seat, just because she's black, she's asked to get up. I mean, sometimes even for me, it's hard to believe the white man's arrogance. Or I might say, no one will ever know exactly what emotional ingredient made this relatively trivial incident a fuse for those Montgomery Negroes. There had been centuries of the worst kind of outrages against Southern black people, lynchings, rapings, shootings, beatings. But you know, history has been triggered by trivial-seeming incidents. Once a little nobody Indian lawyer was put off a train, and fed up with injustice, he twisted a knot in the British lion's tail. His name was Mahatma Gandhi. Or I might copy a trick I'd seen lawyers use, both in life and on television. It was the way that lawyers would slip in before a jury something otherwise inadmissible. Sometimes I think I really might have made it as a lawyer, as I once told that eighth grade teacher in Mason, Michigan, I wanted to be when he advised me to become a carpenter. I would slide right over the reporter's question to drop into his lap a logical extension, hot potato for him. Well, sir, I see the same boycott reasoning for Negroes asked to join the Army, Navy, and Air Force. Why should we go off to die somewhere to preserve a so-called democracy that gives a white immigrant of one day more than it gives the black man with 400 years of slaving and serving in this country? Whites would prefer 50 local boycotts to having 22 million Negroes start thinking about what I had just said. I don't have to tell you that it never got printed the way I said it. It would be turned inside out if it got printed at all. And I could detect when the white reporters had gotten their heads together. They quit asking me certain questions. If I'd developed a good point, though, I'd bait a hook to get it said when I went on radio or television. I'd seem to slip and mention some recent so-called civil rights advance. You know, where some giant industry had hired 10 showpiece Negroes, some restaurant chain had begun making more money by serving Negroes, some Southern university had enrolled a black freshman without bayonets. Like that. When I slipped, the program host would leap on that bait. Ah, indeed, Mr. Malcolm X, you can't deny that's an advance for your race. I jerked the pole then. I can't turn around without hearing about some civil rights advance. White people seem to think the black man ought to be shouting, hallelujah. 400 years the white man has had his foot-long knife in the black man's back, and now the white man starts to wiggle the knife out maybe 6 inches. The black man's supposed to be grateful. Why, if the white man jerked the knife out, it's still going to leave a scar. Similarly, just let some mayor or some city council somewhere boast of having no Negro problem. That would get off the newsroom teletypes, and it would soon be jammed right in my face. I'd say they didn't need to tell me where this was, because I knew that all it meant was that relatively very few Negroes were living there. That's true the world over, you know. Take Democratic England. When 100,000 black West Indians got there, England stopped the black migration. Finland welcomed a Negro U.S. ambassador. Well, let enough Negroes follow him to Finland. Or in Russia, when Khrushchev was in power, he threatened to cancel the visas of black African students whose anti-discrimination demonstration said to the world, Russia, too. The Deep South white press generally blacked me out. But they front-paged what I felt about northern white and black freedom riders going south to demonstrate. I called it ridiculous. Their own northern ghettos, right at home, had enough rats and roaches to kill to keep all of the freedom riders busy. I said that ultra-liberal New York had more integration problems than Mississippi. If the northern freedom riders wanted more to do, they could work on the roots of such ghetto evils as the little children out in the streets at midnight, with apartment keys on strings around their necks to let themselves in, and their mothers and fathers drunk, drug addicts, thieves, prostitutes. Or the northern freedom riders could light some fires under northern city halls, unions, and major industries to give more jobs to Negroes to remove so many of them from the relief and welfare rolls, which created laziness and which deteriorated the ghettos into steadily worse places for humans to live. It was all, it is all, the absolute truth. But what did I want to say it for? Snakes couldn't have turned on me faster than the liberal. Yes, I will pull off that liberal's halo that he spends such efforts cultivating. The North's liberals have been for so long pointing accusing fingers at the South and getting away with it that they have fits when they are exposed as the world's worst hypocrites. I believe my own life mirrors this hypocrisy. I know nothing about the South. I am a creation of the northern white man and of his hypocritical attitude toward the Negro. The white Southerner was always given his due by Mr. Muhammad. The white Southerner, you can say one thing. He is honest. He bares his teeth to the black man. He tells the black man to his face that Southern whites never will accept phony integration. The Southern white goes further to tell the black man that he means to fight him every inch of the way against even the so-called tokenism. The advantage of this is the Southern black man never has been under any illusions about the opposition he is dealing with. You can say for many Southern white people that, individually, they have been paternalistically helpful to many individual Negroes. But the Northern white man, he grins with his teeth, and his mouth has always been full of tricks and lies of equality and integration. When one day all over America a black hand touched the white man's shoulder, and the white man turned, and there stood the Negro saying, "Me too." Why, that Northern liberal shrank from that black man with as much guilt and dread as any Southern white man. Actually, America's most dangerous and threatening black man is the one who has been kept sealed up by the Northerner in the black ghettos. The Northern white power structure system to keep talking democracy while keeping the black man out of sight somewhere, around the corner. The word integration was invented by a Northern liberal. The word has no real meaning. I ask you, in the racial sense in which it's used so much today, whatever integration is supposed to mean, can it precisely be defined? The truth is that integration is an image. It's a foxy Northern liberal smokescreen that confuses the true wants of the American black man. Here in these 50 racist and neo-racist states of North America, this word integration has millions of white people confused and angry, believing wrongly that the black masses want to live mixed up with the white man. That is the case only with the relative handful of these integration-mad Negroes. I'm talking about these token integrated Negroes who flee from their poor, downtrodden black brothers, from their own self-hate, which is what they're really trying to escape. I'm talking about these Negroes you will see who can't get enough of nuzzling up to the white man. These chosen few Negroes are more white-minded, more anti-black than even the white man is. Human rights. Respect as human beings. That's what America's black masses want. That's the true problem. The black masses want not to be shrunk from as though they are plague-ridden. They want not to be walled up in slums, in the ghettos, like animals. They want to live in an open, free society where they can walk with their heads up like men and women. Few white people realize that many black people today dislike and avoid spending any more time than they must around white people. This integration image, as it is popularly interpreted, has millions of vain, self-exalted white people convinced that black people want to sleep in bed with them. And that's a lie. Or you can't tell the average white man that the Negro man's prime desire isn't to have a white woman. Another lie. Like a black brother recently observed to me, "Look, you ever smell one of them wet?" The black masses prefer the company of their own kind. Why, even these fancy bourgeois Negroes, when they get back home from the fancy integrated cocktail parties, what do they do but kick off their shoes and talk about those white liberals they just left as if the liberals were dogs? And the white liberals probably do the very same thing. I can't be sure about the whites. I'm never around them in private. But the bourgeois Negroes know I'm not lying. I'm telling it like it is. You never have to worry about me biting my tongue if something I know as truth is on my mind. Raw, naked truth exchanged between the black man and the white man is what a whole lot more of is needed in this country. To clear the air of the racial mirages, clichés, and lies that this country's very atmosphere has been filled with for 400 years. In many communities, especially small communities, white people have created a benevolent image of themselves as having had so much goodwill toward our Negroes. Every time any local Negro begins suddenly letting the local whites know the truth, that the black people are sick of being hind-tit, second-class, disfranchised, that's when you hear, uttered so sadly, "Unfortunately now, because of this, our whites of goodwill are starting to turn against the Negroes. It's so regrettable. Progress was being made, but now our communications between the races have broken down." What are they talking about? There never was any communication. Until after World War II, there wasn't a single community in the entire United States where the white man heard from any local Negro leaders the truth of what Negroes felt about the conditions that the white community imposed upon Negroes. You need some proof? Well then, why was it that when Negroes did start revolting across America, virtually all of white America was caught up in surprise and even shock? I would hate to be general of an army as badly informed as the American white man has been about the Negro in this country. This is the situation which permitted Negro combustion to slowly build up to the revolution point without the white man realizing it. All over America, the local Negro leader, in order to survive as a leader, kept reassuring the local white man, in effect, "Everything's all right. Everything's right in hand, boss." When the leader wanted a little something for his people, "Boss, some of the people talking about we sure need a better school, boss." And if the local Negroes hadn't been causing any trouble, the benevolent white man might nod and give them a school or some jobs. The white men belonging to the power structures in thousands of communities across America know that I'm right. They know that I'm describing what has been the true pattern of communications between the local whites of goodwill and the local Negroes. It has been a pattern created by domineering, ego-ridden whites. Its characteristic design permitted the white man to feel noble about throwing crumbs to the black man, instead of feeling guilty about the local community system of cruelly exploiting Negroes. But I want to tell you something. This pattern, this system that the white man created of teaching Negroes to hide the truth from him behind a facade of grinning, yes-sir bossing, foot-shuffling, and head-scratching, that system has done the American white man more harm than an invading army would do to him. Why do I say this? Because all this has steadily helped this American white man to build up, deep in his psyche, absolute conviction that he is superior. And how many, many communities have thus white men who didn't finish high school regarded condescendingly university-educated local Negro leaders, principals of schools, teachers, doctors, other professionals. The white man system has been imposed upon non-white peoples all over the world. This is exactly the reason why wherever people who are anything but white live in this world today, the white man's governments are finding themselves in deeper and deeper trouble and peril. Let's just face truth. Facts. Whether or not the white man of the world is able to face truth and facts about the true reasons for his troubles, that's what essentially will determine whether or not he will now survive. Today we are seeing this revolution of the non-white peoples, who just a few years ago would have frozen in horror at the mighty white nation so much as lifted an eyebrow. What it is, simply, is that black and brown and red and yellow peoples have, after hundreds of years of exploitation and imposed inferiority and general misuse, become, finally, do or die sick and tired of the white man's heel on their necks. How can the white American government figure on selling democracy and brotherhood to non-white peoples if they read and hear every day what's going on right here in America and see the better than a thousand words photographs of the American white man denying democracy and brotherhood even to America's native-born non-whites? The world's non-whites know how this Negro here has loved the American white man and slaved for him, tended to him, nursed him. This Negro has jumped into uniform and gone off and died when this America was attacked by enemies, both white and non-white. Such a faithful, loyal non-white as this, and still America bombs him and sets dogs on him and turns fire hoses on him and jails him by the thousands and beats him bloody and inflicts upon him all manner of other crimes. Of course, these things, known and refreshed every day for the rest of the world's non-whites, are a vital factor in these burnings of ambassadors' limousines, these stonings, defilings, and wreckings of embassies and legations, these shouts of, "White man, go home," these attacks on white Christian missionaries, and these bombings and tearing down of flags. Is it clear why I have said that the American white man's malignant superiority complex has done him more harm than an invading army? The American black man should be focusing his every effort toward building his own businesses and decent homes for himself. As other ethnic groups have done, let the black people, wherever possible, however possible, patronize their own kind, hire their own kind, and start in those ways to build up the black race's ability to do for itself. That's the only way the American black man is ever going to get respect. One thing the white man never can give the black man is self-respect. The black man never can become independent and recognized as a human being who is truly equal with other human beings until he has what they have, and until he is doing for himself what others are doing for themselves. The black man in the ghettos, for instance, has to start self-correcting his own material, moral, and spiritual defects and evils. The black man needs to start his own program to get rid of drunkenness, drug addiction, prostitution. The black man in America has to lift up his own sense of values. Only a few thousand of Negroes, relatively a very tiny number, are taking any part in integration. Here again, it's those few bourgeois Negroes rushing to throw away their little money in the white man's luxury hotels, his swanky nightclubs, and big, fine, exclusive restaurants. The white people patronizing those places can afford it. But these Negroes you see in those places can't afford it. Certainly most of them can't. Why, what does some Negro, one installment payment away from disaster, look like? Somewhere downtown, out to dine, grinning at some head waiter who has more money than the Negro. Those bourgeois Negroes out draping big tablecloth-sized napkins over their knees and ordering quail under glass and stewed snails. Why, Negroes don't even like snails. What they're doing is proving they're integrated. If you want to get right down to the real outcome of this so-called integration, what you've got to arrive at is intermarriage. I'm right with the southern white man who believes that you can't have so-called integration, at least not for long, without intermarriage increasing. And what good is this for anyone? Let's again face reality. In a world as color-hostile as this, man or woman, black or white, what do they want with a mate of the other race? Certainly white people have served enough notice of their hostility to any blacks in their families and neighborhoods, and the way most Negroes feel today, a mixed couple probably finds that black families, black communities, are even more hostile than the white ones. So what's bound to face integrated marriages except being unwelcomed, unwanted, misfits in whichever world they try to live in? What we arrive at is that integration, socially, is no good for either side. Integration ultimately would destroy the white race and destroy the black race. The white man's integrating with black women has already changed the complexion and characteristics of the black race in America. What's been proved by the blacks whose complexions are whiter than many white people? I'm told that there are in America today between 2 and 5 million white Negroes who are passing in white society. Imagine their torture, living in constant fear that some black person they have known might meet and expose them. Imagine every day living a lie. Imagine hearing their own white husbands, their own white wives, even their own white children talking about those Negroes. I would doubt if anyone in America has heard Negroes more bitter against the white man than some of those I have heard. But I will tell you that, without any question, the most bitter anti-white diatribes that I have ever heard have come from passing Negroes, living as whites, among whites, exposed every day to what white people say among themselves regarding Negroes, things that a recognized Negro never would hear. Why, if there was a racial showdown, these Negroes passing within white circles would become the black side's most valuable spy and ally. Europe's brown babies, now young men and women who are starting to marry and produce families of their own, have their experiences throughout their lives, scarred as racial freaks, proved anything positive for integration? Integration is called assimilation, if white ethnic groups alone are involved. It's fought against tooth and nail by those who want their heritage preserved. Look at how the Irish threw the English out of Ireland. The Irish knew the English would engulf them. Look at the French Canadians, fanatically fighting to keep their identity. In fact, history's most tragic result of a mixed, therefore diluted and weakened, ethnic identity has been experienced by a white ethnic group, the Jew in Germany. He had made greater contributions to Germany than Germans themselves had. Jews had won over half of Germany's Nobel Prizes. Every culture in Germany was led by the Jew. He published the greatest newspaper. Jews were the greatest artists, the greatest poets, composers, stage directors. But those Jews made a fatal mistake. Assimilating. From World War I to Hitler's rise, the Jews in Germany had been increasingly intermarrying. Many changed their names, and many took other religions. Their own Jewish religion, their own rich Jewish ethnic and cultural roots, they anesthetized and cut off until they began thinking of themselves as Germans. And the next thing they knew, there was Hitler, rising to power from the beer halls with his emotional Aryan master race theory. And right at hand for a scapegoat was the self-weakened, self-deluded German Jew. Most mysterious is how did those Jews, with all of their brilliant minds, with all of their power in every aspect of Germany's affairs, how did those Jews stand almost as if mesmerized, watching something which did not spring upon them overnight, but which was gradually developed, a monstrous plan for their own murder? Their self-brainwashing had been so complete that not long after, in the gas chambers, a lot of them were still gasping, "It can't be true." If Hitler had conquered the world, as he meant to, that is a shuddery thought for every Jew alive today. The Jew never will forget that lesson. Jewish intelligence eyes watch every neo-Nazi organization. Right after the war, the Jews' Haganah mediating body stepped up the long-time negotiations with the British. But this time, the Stern gang was shooting the British. And this time the British acquiesced and helped them to wrest Palestine away from the Arabs, the rightful owners, and then the Jews set up Israel, their own country. The one thing that every race of man in the world respects and understands. Not long ago, the black man in America was fed a dose of another form of the weakening, lulling, and deluding effects of so-called integration. It was that farce on Washington, I call it. The idea of a mass of blacks marching on Washington was originally the brainchild of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, A. Philip Randolph. For 20 or more years, the March on Washington idea had floated around among Negroes, and spontaneously, suddenly now, that idea caught on. Overawed rural southern Negroes, small-town Negroes, northern ghetto Negroes, even thousands of previously Uncle Tom Negroes began talking march. Nothing since Joe Lewis had so coalesced the masses of Negroes. Groups of Negroes were talking of getting to Washington any way they could, in rickety old cars, on buses, hitchhiking, walking even if they had to. They envisioned thousands of black brothers converging together upon Washington to lie down in the streets, on airport runways, on government lawns, demanding of the Congress and the White House some concrete civil rights action. This was a national bitterness, militant, unorganized, and leaderless. Predominantly, it was young Negroes, defiant of whatever might be the consequences, sick and tired of the black man's neck under the white man's heel. The white man had plenty of good reasons for nervous worry. The right spark, some unpredictable emotional chemistry, could set off a black uprising. The government knew that thousands of milling, angry blacks not only could completely disrupt Washington, but they could erupt in Washington. The White House speedily invited in the major civil rights Negro leaders. They were asked to stop the planned march. They truthfully said they hadn't begun it. They had no control over it. The idea was national, spontaneous, unorganized, and leaderless. In other words, it was a black powder keg. Any student of how integration can weaken the black man's movement was about to observe a master lesson. The White House, with a fanfare of international publicity, approved, endorsed, and welcomed a march on Washington. The big civil rights organizations right at this time had been publicly squabbling about donations. The New York Times had broken the story. The NAACP had charged that other agencies' demonstrations, highly publicized, had attracted a major part of the civil rights donations, while the NAACP got left holding the bag, supplying costly bail and legal talent for the other organizations' jailed demonstrators. It was like a movie. The next scene was the Big Six Civil Rights Negro Leaders meeting in New York City with the white head of a big philanthropic agency. They were told that their money wrangling in public was damaging their image. And a reported $800,000 was donated to a United Civil Rights Leadership Council, that was quickly organized by the Big Six. Now, what had instantly achieved black unity? The white man's money. What string was attached to the money? Advice. Not only was there this donation, but another comparable sum was promised for some time later on, after the march. Obviously, if all went well. The original angry march in Washington was now about to be entirely changed. Massive international publicity projected the Big Six as March on Washington leaders. It was news to those angry grassroots Negroes steadily adding steam to their march plans. They probably assumed that now those famous leaders were endorsing and joining them. Invited next to join the march were four famous white public figures, one Catholic, one Jew, one Protestant, and one labor boss. The massive publicity now gently hinted that the Big Ten would supervise the march on Washington's mood and its direction. The four white figures began nodding. The word spread fast among so-called liberal Catholics, Jews, Protestants, and laborites. It was democratic to join this black march. And suddenly the previously march-nervous whites began announcing they were going. It was as if electrical current shot through the ranks of bourgeois Negroes, the very so-called middle class and upper class who had earlier been deploring the march in Washington talk by grassroots Negroes. But white people now were going to march. Why, some downtrodden, jobless, hungry Negro might have gotten trampled. Those integration-mad Negroes practically ran over each other trying to find out where to sign up. The angry blacks marched suddenly had been made chic. Suddenly it had a Kentucky Derby image, for the status seeker was a status symbol. Were you there? You can hear that right today. It had become an outing. A picnic. The morning of the march, any rickety carloads of angry, dusty, sweating small-town Negroes would have gotten lost among the chartered jet planes, railroad cars, and air-conditioned buses. What originally was planned to be an angry riptide, one English newspaper aptly described now as the gentle flood. Talk about integrated, it was like salt and pepper. And by now there wasn't a single logistics aspect uncontrolled. The marchers had been instructed to bring no signs. Signs were provided. They had been told to sing one song, We Shall Overcome. They had been told how to arrive, when, where to arrive, where to assemble, when to start marching, the route to march. First aid stations were strategically located, even where to faint. Yes, I was there. I observed that circus. Whoever heard of angry revolutionists all harmonizing, We shall overcome some day, while tripping and swaying along arm in arm with the very people they were supposed to be angrily revolting against? Whoever heard of angry revolutionists swinging their bare feet together with their oppressor in lily pad park pools with gospels and guitars and I have a dream speeches? And the black masses in America were, and still are, having a nightmare. These angry revolutionists even followed their final instructions to leave early. With all of those thousands upon thousands of angry revolutionists, so few stayed over that the next morning the Washington Hotel Association reported a costly loss in empty rooms. Hollywood couldn't have topped it. In a subsequent press poll, not one congressman or senator with a previous record of opposition to civil rights said he had changed his views. What did anyone expect? How was a one-day, integrated picnic going to counter-influence these representatives of prejudice rooted deep in the psyche of the American white man for 400 years? The very fact that millions, black and white, believed in this monumental farce is another example of how much this country goes in for the surface glossing over, the escape ruse, surfaces, instead of truly dealing with its deep-rooted problems. What that march on Washington did do was lull Negroes for a while. But inevitably, the black masses started realizing that they had been smoothly hoaxed again by the white man. And inevitably, the black man's anger rekindled, deeper than ever, and they began bursting out in different cities in the long, hot summer of 1964, unprecedented racial crises. About a month before the farce on Washington, The New York Times reported me, according to its poll conducted on college and university campuses, as the second most sought-after speaker at colleges and universities. The only speaker ahead of me was Senator Barry Goldwater. I believe that what had generated such college popularity for me was Dr. Lincoln's book, The Black Muslims in America. It had been made required reading in numerous college courses. Then a long, candid interview with me was carried by Playboy magazine, whose circulation on college campuses is the biggest of any magazines. And many students, having studied first the book and then the Playboy interview, wanted to hear in person this so-called fiery black Muslim. When the New York Times poll was published, I'd spoken at well over 50 colleges and universities, like Brown, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Rutgers, in the Ivy League, and others throughout the country. Right now, I have invitations from Cornell, Princeton, and probably a dozen others as soon as my time and their available dates can be scheduled together. Among Negro institutions, I've then been to Atlanta University and Clark College down in Atlanta, to Howard University in Washington, D.C., and to a number of others with small student bodies. Except for all black audiences, I like the college audiences best. The college sessions sometimes ran 2 to 4 hours. They often ran overtime. Challenges, queries, and criticisms were fired at me by the usually objective and always alive and searching minds of undergraduate and graduate students and their faculties. The college sessions never failed to be exhilarating. They never failed in helping me to further my own education. I never experienced one college session that didn't show me ways to improve upon my presentation and defense of Mr. Muhammad's teachings. Sometimes in a panel or debate appearance, I'd find a jam-packed audience to hear me alone, facing 6 or 8 student and faculty scholars, heads of departments such as sociology, psychology, philosophy, history, and religion, and each of them coming at me in his specialty. At the outset, always I'd confront such panels with something such as, "Gentlemen, I finished the 8th grade in Mason, Michigan. My high school was the black ghetto of Roxbury, Massachusetts. My college was in the streets of Harlem, and my master's was taken in prison. Mr. Muhammad has taught me that I never need fear any man's intellect who tries to defend or to justify the white man's criminal record against the non-white man, especially the white man and the black man here in North America." It was like being on a battlefield with intellectual and philosophical bullets. It was an exciting battling with ideas. I got so I could feel my audience's temperaments. I've talked with other public speakers. They agree that this ability is native to any person who has the mass appeal gift, who can get through to and move people. It's a psychic radar. As a doctor with his finger against a pulse is able to feel the heart rate, when I'm up there speaking, I can feel the reaction to what I'm saying. I think I could be speaking blindfolded, and after 5 minutes, I could tell you if sitting out there before me was an all-black or an all-white audience. Black audiences and white audiences feel distinguishably different. Black audiences feel warmer. There's almost a musical rhythm for me, even in their silent response. Question and answer periods are another area where, by now, again blindfolded, I can often tell you the ethnic source of a question. The most easily recognizable of these to me are a Jew in any audience situation and a bourgeois Negro in integrated audiences. My clue to the Jew's question and challenges is that among all other ethnic groups, his expressed thinking, his expressed concerns are the most subjective. And the Jew is usually hypersensitive. I mean, you can't even say Jew without him accusing you of anti-Semitism. I don't care what a Jew is professionally, doctor, merchant, housewife, student, or whatever. First, he or she thinks Jew. Now, of course, I can understand the Jew's hypersensitivity. For 2,000 years, religious and personal prejudices against Jews have been vented and exercised as strong as white prejudices against the non-white. But I know that America's 5.5 million Jews, 2 million of them are concentrated in New York, look at it very practically, whether they know it or not, that all of the bigotry and hatred focused upon the black man keeps off the Jew a lot of heat that would be on him otherwise. For an example of what I'm talking about, in every black ghetto, Jews own the major businesses. Every night, the owners of those businesses go home with that black community's money, which helps the ghetto to stay poor. But I doubt that I have ever uttered this absolute truth before an audience without being hotly challenged and accused by a Jew of anti-Semitism. Why? I will bet that I've told 500 such challenges that Jews as a group would never watch some other minority systematically siphoning out their community's resources without doing something about it. I've told them that if I tell the simple truth, it doesn't mean that I am anti-Semitic. It means merely that I am anti-exploitation. The white liberal may be a little taken aback to know that from all Negro audiences, I never have had one challenge, never one question that defended the white man. That has been true even when a lot of those black bourgeoisie and integration-mad Negroes were among the blacks. All Negroes, among themselves, admit the white man's criminal record. They may not know as many details as I do, but they know the general picture. But let me tell you something significant. This very same bourgeois Negro, who, among Negroes, would never make a fool of himself in trying to defend the white man, watch that same Negro in a mixed black and white audience, knowing he's overheard by his beloved Mr. Charlie. Why, you should hear those Negroes attack me, trying to justify or forgive the white man's crimes. These Negroes are people who bring me nearest to breaking one of my principal rules, which is never to let myself become over-emotional and angry. Why, sometimes I've felt I ought to jump down off that stand and get physical with some of those brainwashed white man's tools, parrots, puppets. At the colleges, I've developed some stock put-downs for them. You must be a law student, aren't you? They have to say either yes or no. And I say, I thought you were. You defend this criminal white man harder than he defends his guilty self. One particular university's token integrated black PhD associate professor I never will forget. He got me so mad I couldn't see straight. As badly as our 22 millions of educationally deprived black people need the help of any brains he has, there he was looking like some fly in the buttermilk among white colleagues, and he was trying to eat me up. He was ranting about what a divisive demagogue and what a reverse racist I was. I was racking my head to spear that fool. Finally, I held up my hand, and he stopped. Do you know what white racists call black PhDs? He said something like, I believe that I happen not to be aware of that. You know, one of these ultra-proper talking Negroes. And I laid the word down on him loud. Nigger. Speaking in these colleges and universities was good for the Nation of Islam. I would report to Mr. Muhammad, because the devilish white man's best minds were developed and influenced in the colleges and universities. But for some reason that I could never understand until much later, Mr. Muhammad never really wanted me to speak at these colleges and universities. I was to learn later, from Mr. Muhammad's own sons, that he was envious because he felt unequipped to speak at colleges himself. But nevertheless, on Mr. Muhammad's behalf at this time, I was finding these highly intelligent audiences amazingly open-minded and objective in their receptions of the raw, naked truths that I would tell them. Time and time again, the black, the brown, the red, and the yellow races have witnessed and suffered the white man's small ability to understand the simple notes of the spirit. The white man seems tone-deaf to the total orchestration of humanity. Every day, his newspaper's front pages show us the world that he has created. God's wrathful judgment is close upon this white man, stumbling and groping blindly in wickedness and evil and spiritual darkness. Look, remaining today are only two giant white nations, America and Russia, each of them with mistrustful, nervous satellites. America is propping up most of the remaining white world. The French, the Belgians, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the Spanish, and other white nations have weakened steadily as non-white Asians and Africans have recovered their lands. America is subsidizing what is left of the prestige and strength of the once mighty Britain. The sun has set forever on that monocled, pith-helmeted resident colonialist, sipping tea with his delicate lady in the non-white colonies being systematically robbed of every valuable resource. Britain's superfluous royalty and nobility now exist by charging tourists to inspect the once baronial castles and by selling memoirs, perfumes, autographs, titles, and even themselves. The whole world knows that the white man cannot survive another war. If either of the two giant white nations pushes the button, white civilization will die. And we see again that not ideologies, but race and color is what binds human beings. Is it accidental that as Red Chinese visit African and Asian countries, Russia and America draw steadily closer to each other? The collective white man's history has left the non-white peoples no alternative either but to draw closer to each other. Characteristically, as always, the devilish white man lacks the moral strength and courage to cast off his arrogance. He wants today to buy friends among the non-whites. He tries characteristically to cover up his past record. He does not possess the humility to admit his guilt, to try and atone for his crimes. The white man has perverted the simple message of love that the prophet Jesus lived and taught when he walked upon this earth. Audiences seemed surprised when I spoke about Jesus. I would explain that we Muslims believe in the prophet Jesus. He was one of the three most important prophets of the religion of Islam, the others being Muhammad and Moses. In Jerusalem, there are Muslim shrines built to the prophet Jesus. I would explain that it was our belief that Christianity did not perform what Christ taught. I never failed to cite that even Billy Graham, challenged in Africa, had himself made the distinction. I believe in Christ, not Christianity. I never will forget one little blonde co-ed after I'd spoken at her New England college. She must have caught the next plane behind that one I took to New York. She found the Muslim restaurant in Harlem. I just happened to be there when she came in. Her clothes, her carriage, her accent all showed deep South white breeding and money. At that college, I told how the antebellum white slave master even devilishly manipulated his own woman. He convinced her that she was too pure for his base animal instincts. With this noble ruse, he conned his own wife to look away from his obvious preference for the animal black woman. So the delicate mistress sat and watched the plantation's little mongrel-complexioned children, sired obviously by her father, her husband, her brothers, her sons. I said at that college that the guilt of American whites included their knowledge that in hating Negroes, they were hating, they were rejecting, they were denying their own blood. Anyway, I'd never seen anyone I ever spoke before more affected than this little white college girl. She demanded, right up in my face, "Don't you believe there are any good white people?" I didn't want to hurt her feelings. I told her, "People's deeds I believe in, miss, not their words." "What can I do?" she exclaimed. I told her, "Nothing." She burst out crying and ran out and up Lenox Avenue and caught a taxi. Mr. Muhammad, each time I'd go to see him in Chicago or in Phoenix, would warm me with his expressions of his approval and confidence in me. He left me in charge of the Nation of Islam's affairs when he made an Umrah pilgrimage to the holy city Mecca. I believed so strongly in Mr. Muhammad that I would have hurled myself between him and an assassin. A chance event brought crashing home to me that there was something, one thing, greater than my reverence for Mr. Muhammad. It was the awesomeness of my reason to revere him. I was the invited speaker at the Harvard Law School Forum. I happened to glance through a window. Abruptly, I realized that I was looking in the direction of the apartment house that was my old burglary gang's hideout. It rocked me like a tidal wave. Scenes from my once depraved life lashed through my mind. Living like an animal. Thinking like an animal. Awareness came surging up in me. How deeply the religion of Islam had reached down into the mud to lift me up, to save me from being what I inevitably would have been, a dead criminal in a grave, or if still alive, a flint-hard, bitter 37-year-old convict in some penitentiary or insane asylum. Or at best, I would have been an old, failing Detroit red, hustling, stealing enough for food and narcotics, and myself being stalked as prey by cruelly ambitious younger hustlers such as Detroit Red had been. But Allah had blessed me to learn about the religion of Islam, which had enabled me to lift myself up from the muck and the mire of this rotting world. And there I stood, the invited speaker at Harvard. A story that I had read in prison when I was reading a lot of Greek mythology flicked into my head. The boy Icarus. Do you remember the story? Icarus' father made some wings that he fastened with wax. "Never fly but so high with these wings," the father said. but soaring around, this way, that way, Icarus flying pleased him so that he began thinking he was flying on his own merit. Higher he flew, higher, until the heat of the sun melted the wax holding those wings, and down came Icarus, tumbling. Standing there by that harvard window, I silently vowed to Allah that I never would forget that any wings I wore had been put on by the religion of Islam. That fact I never have forgotten. Not for one second. Chapter 16. Out. In 1961, Mr. Muhammad's condition grew suddenly worse. As he talked with me when I visited him, when he talked with anyone, he would unpredictably begin coughing harder and harder until his body was racked and jerking in agonies that were painful to watch, and Mr. Muhammad would have to take to his bed. We, among Mr. Muhammad's officials and his family, kept the situation to ourselves while we could. Few other Muslims became aware of Mr. Muhammad's condition until there were last-minute cancellations of long-advertised personal appearances at some big Muslim rallies. Muslims knew that only something really serious would ever have stopped the messenger from keeping his promise to be with them at their rallies. Their questions had to be answered, and the news of our leader's illness swiftly spread through the nation of Islam. Anyone not a Muslim could not conceive what the possible loss of Mr. Muhammad would have meant among his followers. To us, the nation of Islam was Mr. Muhammad. What bonded us into the best organization black Americans ever had was every Muslim's devout regard for Mr. Muhammad as black America's moral, mental, and spiritual reformer. Stated another way, we Muslims regarded ourselves as moral and mental and spiritual examples for other black Americans because we followed the personal example of Mr. Muhammad. Black communities discussed with respect how Muslims were suspended if they lied, gambled, cheated, or smoked. For moral crimes, such as fornication or adultery, Mr. Muhammad personally would mete out sentences of from 1 to 5 years of isolation, if not complete expulsion from the nation. And Mr. Muhammad would punish his officials more readily than the newest convert in a mosque. He said that any defecting official betrayed both himself and his position as a leader and example for other Muslims. For every Muslim, in his rejection of immoral temptation, the beacon was Mr. Muhammad. All Muslims felt as one that without his light, we would all be in darkness. As I related, doctors recommended a dry climate to ease Mr. Muhammad's condition. Quickly we found up for sale in Phoenix the home of the saxophone player Louis Jordan. The nation's treasury purchased the home, and Mr. Muhammad soon moved there. Only by being two people could I have worked harder in the service of the Nation of Islam. I had every gratification that I wanted. I'd helped bring about the progress and national impact such that none could call us liars when we called Mr. Muhammad the most powerful black man in America. I had helped Mr. Muhammad and his other ministers to revolutionize the American black man's thinking, opening his eyes until he would never again look in the same fearful, worshipful way at the white man. I had participated in spreading the truths that had done so much to help the American black man rid himself of the mirage that the white race was made up of superior beings. I had been a part of the tapping of something in the black secret soul. If I harbored any personal disappointment whatsoever, it was that privately I was convinced that our Nation of Islam could be an even greater force in the American black man's overall struggle if we engaged in more action. By that I mean I thought privately that we should have amended or relaxed our general non-engagement policy. I felt that wherever black people committed themselves, in the Little Rocks and the Birminghams and other places, militantly disciplined Muslims should also be there for all the world to see and respect and discuss. It could be heard increasingly in the Negro communities. Those Muslims talk tough, but they never do anything unless somebody bothers Muslims. I moved around among outsiders more than most other Muslim officials. I felt the very real potentiality that, considering the mercurial moods of the black masses, this labeling of Muslims as talk only could see us, powerful as we were, one day suddenly separated from the Negro's front-line struggle. But beyond that single personal concern, I couldn't have asked Allah to bless my efforts any more than he had. Islam in New York City was growing faster than anywhere in America. From the one tiny mosque to which Mr. Muhammad had originally sent me, I had now built three of the nation's most powerful and aggressive mosques. Harlem's 7A in Manhattan, Corona's 7B in Queens, and Mosque 7C in Brooklyn. And on a national basis, I'd either directly established or I'd helped to establish most of the 100 or more mosques in the 50 states. I was crisscrossing North America sometimes as often as 4 times a week. Often what sleep I got was caught in the jet planes. I was maintaining a marathon schedule of press, radio, television, and public speaking commitments. The only way that I could keep up with my job for Mr. Muhammad was by flying with the wings that he had given me. As far back as 1961, when Mr. Muhammad's illness took that turn for the worse, I had heard chance negative remarks concerning me. I'd heard veiled implications. I noticed other little evidences of the envy and of the jealousy which Mr. Muhammad had prophesied. For example, it was being said that Minister Malcolm is trying to take over the nation. It was being said that I was taking credit for Mr. Muhammad's teaching. It was being said that I was trying to build an empire for myself. It was being said that I loved playing coast-to-coast Mr. Big Shot. When I heard these things, actually, they didn't anger me. They helped me to re-steel my inner resolve that such lies would never become true of me. I would always remember that Mr. Muhammad had prophesied this envy and jealousy. This would help me to ignore it, because I knew that he would understand if he ever should hear such talk. A frequent rumor among non-Muslims was, Malcolm X is making a pile of money. All Muslims at least knew better than that. Me? Making money? The FBI and the CIA and the IRS all combined can't turn up a thing I got beyond a car to drive and a 7-room house to live in. And by now the Nation of Islam is jealously and greedily trying to take away even that house. I had access to money. Yes, Elijah Muhammad will authorize for me any amount that I ask for. But he knew, as every Muslim official knew, that every nickel and dime I ever got was used to promote the Nation of Islam. My attitude toward money generated the only domestic quarrel that I have ever had with my beloved wife, Betty. As our children increased in number, so did Betty's hints to me that I should put away something for our family. But I refused, and finally we had this argument. I put my foot down. I knew I had in Betty a wife who would sacrifice her life for me if such an occasion ever presented itself to her. But still I told her that too many organizations had been destroyed by leaders who tried to benefit personally, often goaded into it by their wives. We nearly broke up over this argument. I finally convinced Betty that if anything ever happened to me, the Nation of Islam would take care of her for the rest of her life and of our children until they were grown. I could never have been a bigger fool. In every radio or television appearance, in every newspaper interview, I always made it crystal clear that I was Mr. Muhammad's representative. Anyone who ever heard me make a public speech during this time knows that at least once a minute I said, "The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches, I would refuse to talk with any person who ever tried any so-called joke about my constant reference to Mr. Muhammad." Whenever anyone said or wrote, "Malcolm X, the number two black Muslim," I would recoil. I've called up reporters and radio and television newscasters long distance and asked them never to use that phrasing again, explaining to them, all Muslims are number two, after Mr. Muhammad. My briefcase was stocked with Mr. Muhammad's photographs. I gave them to photographers who snapped my picture. I would telephone editors asking them, please use Mr. Muhammad's picture instead of mine. When, to my joy, Mr. Muhammad agreed to grant interviews to white writers, I rarely spoke to a white writer, or a black one either, whom I didn't urge to visit Mr. Muhammad in person in Chicago. Get the truth from the messenger in person. And a number of them did go there and meet and interview him. Both white people and Negroes, even including Muslims, would make me uncomfortable, always giving me so much credit for the steady progress that the Nation of Islam was making. All praise is due to Allah, I told everybody. Anything creditable that I do is due to Mr. Elijah Muhammad. I believe that no man in the Nation of Islam could have gained the international prominence I gained with the wings Mr. Muhammad had put on me, plus having the freedom that he granted me to take liberties and do things on my own, and still have remained as faithful and as selfless a servant to him as I was. I would say that it was in 1962 when I began to notice that less and less about me appeared in our nation's Muhammad Speaks, I learned that Mr. Muhammad's son, Herbert, now the paper's publisher, had instructed that as little as possible be printed about me. In fact, there was more in the Muslim paper about integrationist Negro leaders than there was about me. I could read more about myself in the European, Asian, and African press. I'm not griping about publicity for myself. I already have received more publicity than many world personages. But I resented the fact that the Muslims' own newspaper denied them news of important things being done in their behalf simply because it happened that I had done the things. I was conducting rallies, trying to propagate Mr. Muhammad's teachings, and because of jealousy and narrow-mindedness, finally I got no coverage at all. For by now an order had been given to completely black me out of the newspaper. For instance, I spoke to 8,000 students at the University of California, and the press there gave big coverage to what I said of the power and program of Mr. Muhammad. But when I got to Chicago, expecting at least a favorable response and some coverage, I met only a chilly reaction. The same thing happened when, in Harlem, I staged a rally that drew 7,000 people. At that time, Chicago headquarters was even discouraging me from staging large rallies. But the next week, I held another Harlem rally that was even bigger and more successful than the first one. And obviously, this only increased the envy of the Chicago headquarters. But I would put these things out of my mind as they occurred. At least as much as I humanly could, I put them out of my mind. I'm not trying to make myself seem right and noble. I'm telling the truth. I loved the nation and Mr. Muhammad. I lived for the nation and for Mr. Muhammad. It made other Muslim officials jealous because my picture was often in the daily press. They wouldn't remember that my picture was there because of my fervor in championing Mr. Muhammad. They wouldn't simply reason that as vulnerable as the nation of Islam was to distorted rumors and outright lies, we needed nothing so little as to have our public spokesman constantly denying the rumors. Common sense would have told any official that certainly Mr. Muhammad couldn't be running all over the country as his own spokesman, and whoever he appointed as his spokesman couldn't avoid a lot of press focus. Whenever I caught any resentful feelings hanging on in my mind, I would be ashamed of myself, considering it a sign of weakness in myself. I knew that at least Mr. Muhammad knew that my life was totally dedicated to representing him. But during 1963, I couldn't help being very hypersensitive to my critics and high posts within our nation. I quit selecting certain of my New York brothers and giving them money to go and lay groundwork for new mosques in other cities, because slighting remarks were being made about Malcolm's ministers. In a time in America when it was of arch importance for a militant black voice to reach mass audiences, Life magazine wanted to do a personal story of me, and I refused. I refused again when a cover story was offered by Newsweek. I refused again when I could have been a guest on the top-rated Meet the Press television program. Each refusal was a general loss for the black man, and for the Nation of Islam, each refusal was a specific loss, and each refusal was made because of Chicago's attitude. There was jealousy because I'd been requested to make these featured appearances. When a high-powered rifle slug tore through the back of the NAACP field secretary, Medgar Evers, in Mississippi, I wanted to say the blunt truths that needed to be said. When a bomb was exploded in a Negro Christian church in Birmingham, Alabama, snuffing out the lives of those four beautiful little black girls, I made comments, but not what should have been said about the climate of hate that the American white man was generating and nourishing. The more hate was permitted to lash out when there were ways it could have been checked, the more bold the hate became, until at last it was flaring out at even the white man's own kind, including his own leaders. In Dallas, Texas, for instance, the then Vice President and Mrs. Johnson were vulgarly insulted. And the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, was spat upon and hit on the head by a white woman picket. Mr. Muhammad made me the nation's first national minister. At a late 1963 rally in Philadelphia, Mr. Muhammad, embracing me, said to that audience before us, "This is my most faithful, hard-working minister. He will follow me until he dies." He had never paid such a compliment to any Muslim. No praise from any other earthly person could have meant more to me. But this would be Mr. Muhammad's and my last public appearance together. Not long before, I'd been on the Jerry Williams radio program in Boston when someone handed me an item hot off the Associated Press machine. I read that a chapter of the Louisiana Citizens Council had just offered a $10,000 reward for my death. but the threat of death was much closer to me than somewhere in Louisiana. What I'm telling you is the truth. When I discovered who else wanted me dead, I'm telling you, it nearly sent me to Bellevue. In my 12 years as a Muslim minister, I'd always taught so strongly on the moral issues that many Muslims accused me of being anti-woman. The very keel of my teaching and my most bone-deep personal belief was that Elijah Muhammad in every aspect of his existence was a symbol of moral, mental, and spiritual reform among the American black people. For 12 years, I had taught that within the entire nation of Islam, my own transformation was the best example I knew of Mr. Muhammad's power to reform black men's lives. From the time I entered prison until I married, about 12 years later, because of Mr. Muhammad's influence upon me, I had never touched a woman. But around 1963, if anyone had noticed, I spoke less and less of religion. I taught social doctrine to Muslims and current events and politics. I stayed wholly off the subject of morality. And the reason for this was that my faith had been shaken in a way that I can never fully describe. For I had discovered Muslims had been betrayed by Elijah Muhammad himself. I want to make this as brief as I can, only enough so that my position and my reactions will be understood. As to whether or not I should reveal this, there's no longer any need for any question in my mind. For now the public knows. To make it concise, I will quote from one wire service story as it appeared in newspapers and was reported over radio and television across the United States. Los Angeles, July 3rd, UPI. Elijah Muhammad, 67-year-old leader of the Black Muslim Movement, today faced paternity suits from two former secretaries who charged he fathered their four children. Both women are in their 20s. Miss Rosary and Miss Williams charged they had intimacies with Elijah Muhammad from 1957 until this year. Miss Rosary alleged he fathered her two children and said she was expecting a third child by him. The other plaintiff said he was the father of her daughter. As far back as 1955, I'd heard hints. But believe me when I tell you this, for me even to consider believing anything as insane sounding as any slightest implication of any immoral behavior of Mr. Muhammad, why, the very idea made me shake with fear. And so my mind simply refused to accept anything so grotesque as adultery mentioned in the same breath with Mr. Muhammad's name. Adultery. Why, any Muslim guilty of adultery was summarily ousted in disgrace. One of the nation's most closely kept scandals was that a succession of the personal secretaries of Mr. Muhammad had become pregnant. They were brought before Muslim courts and charged with adultery, and they confessed. Humiliated before the general body, they received sentences of from 1 to 5 years of isolation. That meant they would have no contact whatsoever with any other Muslims. I don't think I could say anything which better testifies to my depth of faith in Mr. Muhammad than that I totally and absolutely rejected my own intelligence. I simply refused to believe. I didn't want Allah to burn my brain, as I felt the brain of my brother Reginald had been burned for harboring evil thoughts about Mr. Elijah Muhammad. The last time I'd seen Reginald, one day he walked into the Mosque 7 restaurant. I saw him coming in the door. I went and met him. I looked into my own brother's eyes. I told him he wasn't welcome among Muslims. And he turned around and left. And I haven't seen him since. I did that to my own blood brother because years before, Mr. Muhammad had sentenced Reginald to isolation from all other Muslims. And I considered that I was a Muslim before I was Reginald's brother. No one in the world could have convinced me that Mr. Muhammad would betray the reverence bestowed upon him by all of the mosques full of poor, trusting Muslims, nickeling and diming up to faithfully support the nation of Islam, when many of these faithful were scarcely able to pay their own rents. But by late 1962, I learned reliably that numerous Muslims were leaving Mosque 2 in Chicago. The ugly rumor was spreading swiftly, even among non-Muslim Negroes. When I thought of how the press constantly sought ways to discredit the Nation of Islam, I trembled to think of such a thing reaching the ears of some newspaper reporter, either black or white. I actually began to have nightmares. I saw headlines. I was burdened with a leaden fear as I kept speaking engagements all over America. Any time a reporter came anywhere near me, I could hear him ask, "Is it true, Mr. Malcolm X, this report we hear that..." And what was I going to say? There was never any specific moment when I admitted the situation to myself. In the way that the human mind can do, somehow I slid over admitting to myself the ugly fact, even as I began dealing with it. Both in New York and Chicago, non-Muslims whom I knew began to tell me indirectly they had heard, or they would ask me if I had heard. I would act as if I had no idea whatever of what they were talking about, and I was grateful when they chose not to spell out what they knew. I went around knowing that I looked to them like a total fool. I felt like a total fool, out there every day preaching and apparently not knowing what was going on right under my nose in my own organization involving the very man I was praising so. To look like a fool unearthed emotions I hadn't felt since my Harlem hustler days. The worst thing in the hustler's world was to be a dupe. I will give you an example. Backstage at the Apollo Theater in Harlem one day, the comedian Dick Gregory looked at me. "Man," he said, "Muhammad's nothing but a..." I can't say the word he used. Bam! Just like that. My Muslim instinct said to attack Dick. But instead, I felt weak and hollow. I think Dick sensed how upset I was, and he let me get him off the subject. I knew Dick, a Chicagoan, was wise in the way of the streets and blunt-spoken. I wanted to plead with him not to say to anyone else what he had said to me. But I couldn't. It would have been my own admission. I can't describe the torments I went through. Always before, in any extremity, I'd caught the first plane to Mr. Elijah Muhammad. He'd virtually raised me from the dead. Everything I was that was creditable, he'd made me. I felt that no matter what, I could not let him down. There was no one I could turn to with this problem except Mr. Muhammad himself. Ultimately, that had to be the case. But first I went to Chicago to see Mr. Muhammad's second youngest son, Wallace Muhammad. I felt that Wallace was Mr. Muhammad's most strongly spiritual son, the son with the most objective outlook. Always, Wallace and I had shared an exceptional closeness and trust. And Wallace knew when he saw me why I had come to see him. "I know," he said. I said I thought we should rally to help his father. Wallace said he didn't feel that his father would welcome any efforts to help him. I told myself that Wallace must be crazy. Next, I broke the rule that no Muslim is supposed to have any contact with another Muslim in the isolated state. I looked up, and I talked with three of the former secretaries to Mr. Muhammad. From their own mouths, I heard their stories of who had fathered their children. And from their own mouths, I heard that Elijah Muhammad had told them I was the best, the greatest minister he ever had, but that someday I would leave him, turn against him. So I was dangerous. I learned from these former secretaries of Mr. Muhammad that while he was praising me to my face, he was tearing me apart behind my back. That deeply hurt me. Every day, I was meeting the microphones, cameras, press reporters, and other commitments, including the Muslims of my own Mosque 7. I felt almost out of my mind. Finally, the thing crystallized for me. As long as I did nothing, I felt it was the same as being disloyal. I felt that as long as I sat down, I was not helping Mr. Muhammad, when somebody needed to be standing up. So one night I wrote to Mr. Muhammad about the poison being spread about him. He telephoned me in New York. He said that when he saw me, he would discuss it. I desperately wanted to find some way, some kind of a bridge, over which I was certain the Nation of Islam could be saved from self-destruction. I had faith in the nation. We weren't some group of Christian Negroes jumping and shouting and full of sins. I thought of one bridge that could be used, if and when the shattering disclosure should become public. Loyal Muslims could be taught that a man's accomplishments in his life outweigh his personal human weaknesses. Wallace Muhammad helped me to review the Quran and the Bible for documentation. David's adultery with Bathsheba weighed less on history's scales, for instance, than the positive fact of David's killing Goliath. Thinking of Lot, we think not of incest, but of his saving the people from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Or our image of Noah isn't of his getting drunk, but of his building the ark and teaching people to save themselves from the flood. We think of Moses leading the Hebrews from bondage, not of Moses' adultery with the Ethiopian women. In all of the cases I reviewed, the positive outweighed the negative. I began teaching in New York Mosque 7 that a man's accomplishments in his life outweighed his personal human weaknesses. I taught that a person's good deeds outweigh his bad deeds. I never mentioned the previously familiar subjects of adultery and fornication, and I never mentioned immoral evils. By some miracle, the adultery talk, which was so widespread in Chicago, seemed to only leak a little in Boston, Detroit, and New York. Apparently it hadn't reached other mosques around the country at all. In Chicago, increasing numbers of Muslims were leaving mosque too, I heard, and many non-Muslims who had been sympathetic to the nation were now outspokenly anti-Muslim. In February 1963, I officiated at the University of Islam graduation exercises. When I introduced various members of the Muhammad family, I could feel the cold chill toward them from the Muslims in the audience. Elijah Muhammad had me fly to Phoenix to see him in April 1963. We embraced, as always, and almost immediately he took me outside, where we began to walk by a swimming pool. He was the messenger of Allah. When I was a foul, vicious convict, so evil that other convicts had called me Satan, this man had rescued me. He was the man who had trained me, who had treated me as if I were his own flesh and blood. He was the man who had given me wings to go places, to do things I otherwise never would have dreamed of. We walked, with me caught up in a whirlwind of emotions. "Well, son," Mr. Muhammad said, "what is on your mind?" Plainly, frankly, pulling no punches, I told Mr. Muhammad what was being said, and without waiting for any response from him, I said that with his son Wallace's help, I'd found in the Quran and the Bible that which might be taught to Muslims, if it became necessary, as the fulfillment of prophecy. "Son, I'm not surprised," Elijah Muhammad said. "You always have had such a good understanding of prophecy and of spiritual things. You recognize that's what all of this is. Prophecy. You have the kind of understanding that only an old man has." "I'm David," he said. "When you read about how David took another's wife, I'm that David. You read about Noah, who got drunk. That's me. You read about Lot, who went and laid up with his own daughters. I have to fulfill all of those things." I remembered that when an epidemic is about to hit somewhere, that community's people are inoculated against exposure with some of the same germs that are anticipated, and this prepares them to resist the oncoming virus. I decided I'd better prepare 6 other East Coast Muslim officials whom I selected. I told them, and then I told them why I had told them, that I felt they should not be caught by surprise and shock if it became their job to teach the Muslims in their mosques the fulfillment of prophecy. I found then that some had already heard it. One of them, Minister Louis X of Boston, as much as 7 months before. They had been living with the dilemma themselves. I never dreamed that the Chicago Muslim officials were going to make it appear that I was throwing gasoline on the fire instead of water. I never dreamed that they were going to try to make it appear that instead of inoculating against an epidemic, I had started it. The stage in Chicago even then was being set for Muslims to shift their focus off the epidemic and onto me. Hating me was going to become the cause for people of shattered faith to rally around. Non-Muslim Negroes who knew me well, and even some of the white reporters with whom I had some regular contact, were telling me almost wherever I went, "Malcolm X, you're looking tired. You need a rest." They didn't know a fraction of it. Since I'd been a Muslim, this was the first time any white people really got to me in a personal way. I could tell that some of them were really honest and sincere. One of these, whose name I won't call, he might lose his job, said, "Malcolm X, the whites need your voice worse than the Negroes." I remember so well his saying this because it prefaced the first time since I became a Muslim that I had ever talked with any white man at any length about anything except the Nation of Islam and the American black man's struggle today. I can't remember how or why he somehow happened to mention the Dead Sea Scrolls. I came back with something like, "Yes, those scrolls are going to take Jesus off the stained glass windows and the frescoes where he's been lily white, and put him back into the true mainstream of history, where Jesus actually was non-white." The reporter was surprised, and I went on that the Dead Sea Scrolls were going to reaffirm that Jesus was a member of that brotherhood of Egyptian seers called the Essene. a fact already known from Philo, the famous Egyptian historian of Jesus' time. And the reporter and I got off on about 2 good hours of talking in the areas of archaeology, history, and religion. It was so pleasant. I almost forgot the heavy worries on my mind for that brief respite. I remember we wound up agreeing that by the year 2000, every school child would be taught the true color of great men of antiquity. I've said that I expected headlines momentarily. I hadn't expected the kind which came. No one needs to be reminded of who got assassinated in Dallas, Texas, on November 22, 1963. Within hours after the assassination, I'm telling nothing but the truth. Every Muslim minister received from Mr. Elijah Muhammad a directive. In fact, 2 directives. Every minister was ordered to make no remarks at all concerning the assassination. Mr. Muhammad instructed that if pressed for comment, we should say, no comment. End of side 8.